Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the sermon and musical selection from our February 7th service. Dennis Reynolds' sermon topic is The Heart of History. The musical selection is Heart of the Appaloosa by Fred Small, performed by Dana Lyons. Thanks for listening.
I'm reminded when I had the opportunity to visit here and to stand in this pulpit, of how heart connections endure. For those of who were here then and those who read the bio will note I was the intern minister here in 2009-2010 and got to be part of the ceremony of carrying the chalice from what's now the social hall into this sacred space. And I'm reminded of what kinship and connections feel like. And they run deep. Now, that song that Dana shared is a chapter in a much broader and larger story of history. The song sings of Chief Joseph, a leader of the Nez Perce tribe, people who call themselves the Nimi'upu, the people. The song's story is about how Joseph led a band of men and women, children, when they fled their homeland. He left behind his Christian name, Joseph, and I was reminded this morning, and burnt his Bible and reclaimed his birth name, Him-ma-tu-ya-la-ka-ket, which in English is translated to mean thunder rolling in the mountain. In defiance of the United States government, he's led his people across the Great Divide, the Rockies, to seek freedom in Canada. The saddest part of the story is they did not quite make it. Many died, and their beloved Appaloosa horses were taken from them, and they were stopped 40 miles from the Canadian border, where they had hoped to cross and gather with remnants of the Sioux Nation to find a new home. On that day, Joseph said in a much publicized speech, "From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." Why do we lift up such a sad story? Why do we hold it in our memories? Why do we study such unfortunate and sad chapters in history? Isn't all of that behind us back there someplace? Shouldn't we just look forward? Well, here's my list of reasons why I think it's important to study the past. Number one, history includes both the big macro stories and the individual tales of how humans in the past have behaved. It thus shines a light on tendencies of human nature. It's not just about some them back then. It's about us in the here and now. Number two, historical events and views still shape the present, both in terms of the big stories about things like treaties that resulted in current borders and such, and it's about how stories from the past are central in creating a particular mythos that we adopt as the truth. Number three, history does indeed often repeat itself, and we might avoid repeating the same mistakes in both our personal lives and in the bigger picture of how systems function when we pay attention to history. Number four, history can offer truth that explains current realities, often again in both our personal stories and in the big macro stories of nations and wars and all of that. For all of these reasons, and because I must admit I simply enjoy reading about and pondering the past, I explore and lift up the truth of history. My own appreciation and enjoyment of history began back when I was about 8 years old. That would have been 1958, the year that my home state of Oregon turned 100. There were special centennial celebrations, and the school kids studied with special vigor the history of our state. I remember one little incident. My father won a prize at his workplace for growing the biggest beard in a year. It was an intriguing look back at history. And the schools were particularly focused on Oregon history. And there were contests of various kinds. I remember one statewide initiative was to solicit pictures and stories of historic events for inclusion in a special kid-created Oregon history book. Now, the picture I drew was a not too skillfully executed drawing of an Appaloosa horse. It was intended to go with an essay about the Nez Perce people and how they had provided horses for Lewis and Clark to use on the Core of Discovery in order that they could successfully return from that arduous journey. There were accounts in the Explorer's Journey about the fine horses and the fine people that they had met. Though neither my essay nor my picture were chosen for the history book, the story of those people and their horses stayed in my mind and touched my heart. I loved stories about the Nez Perce and the amazing horse, the Appaloosa. I remember wishing I could be Nez Perce, or failing that, at least have an Appaloosa stallion of my own. I actually got closer to the former than I ever did to obtaining such a horse. You see, my mother grew up in Palouse, Washington, very near the Idaho border, and one of her aunts married a Nez Perce man. And thus, several of her cousins were Nez Perce. So, I have some Nez Perce kin. One of those cousins, Eloise, was present at an extended family gathering just this past holiday season. I remember Mom used to tell stories of visiting her Indian cousins and her white cousins. The latter were wheat farmers who eventually gained ownership of vast acreages on the lands her native cousins' forebears had once ridden across on their amazing horses. The white cousins became very wealthy. The Indian cousins, well, not so much. Now, many of those kids would go off to reservation schools, and only some ever returned to Idaho. My mom's favorite cousin married a Hopi man she met at school, and they moved to the Southwest to raise a family on a Hopi reservation. I love to read the stories of the Nez Perce people, to whom I had a familial connection, and I especially loved the Appaloosa horse. A few years back, I went to visit Palouse and the reservation in the town of Nez Perce. I talked to the staff at the info center at the Nez Perce National Historical Park about my kin who lived in the area. They knew of both the Riggers, the white wheat farmers, and the Moffats, my Nez Perce kin. Long after I was in school, I realized that the source of the economic gaps that existed between the branches of my extended clan had been seeded long ago. The truth of our shared history is that the Nez Perce generosity towards Americans had not been returned in kind. Within a generation of Lewis and Clark's journey across their vast tribal lands, many Nez Perce had been relegated to the reservations and were considered wards of the state. I was not taught in school about the 20th century reality of the Nez Perce. At the time of the Lewis and Clark, they had been a tribe of some 12,000 plus members whose seasonal travels took them across 17 million acres of land in parts of Washington, Idaho, and Montana. In my time, in our time, they were expected to live on the current reservation of about 750,000 acres. on some of the most marginal valued land in the region. The current tribal records list a mere 3,500 people who call themselves Nimi'upu. The larger story, of which the Nez Perce chapter is just a part, is not a new story. Throughout history, some have called themselves the chosen people, with special rights of dominion over lands they entered and over people they subdued. It seems to have happened in prehistory, in ancient history, in the expansions of Western colonialism and Western capitalism across the globe. Western hegemony has expanded and globalized and uses its own particular view of history as a way to justify itself. In the early days of Western globalization, it was justified under something called the doctrine of discovery. And this doctrine was affirmed by the highest authority. A papal decree issued by Pope Nicholas V in 1542 specifically sanctioned and promoted the conquest, colonization, and exploitation of non-Christian territories and peoples. Now, in response to this initial decree was in response to European explorations and conquests in Africa. And just to make sure that there would be no doubt that such a standard would apply to the so-called New World when it was discovered, there was another papal bill written in 1493 by Pope Alexander VI, which read, "By the authority of Almighty God conferred upon us by Blessed Peter and the Vicarship of Jesus Christ, we give, grant, and assign to you and your heirs and successors, kings of Castile and Leon, forever, together with their dominions, cities, camps, places, and villages, all rights and jurisdictions, all the islands and mainlands found and to be found. Let no one therefore infringe or with rash boldness contravene this our recommendation. Be it known to him that he will incur the wrath of Almighty God and the blessed apostles." So it was said. So when the conquistadors came to this hemisphere, they became much more than mere fortune hunters. They were rather holy privateers, authorized by the church in the name of God and taking whatever steps they deemed necessary to subdue the people in the lands they found, to seize their goods and lands for their own benefit and the wishes of their kings and queens and their God. And it did not stop when colonization stalled. It simply got renamed. In Africa, it came to be called the white man's burden. White man's benefit would have been closer to the truth. Here in the United States, we came to call it manifest destiny. The assumed right of our forebearers to go forth and conquer the lands and peoples of this continent by whatever means deemed necessary. The doctrine of discovery was later used as precedent in U.S. law. In the famous, or perhaps from an indigenous perspective, infamous, 1823 Supreme Court ruling, Johnson versus McIntosh, Chief Justice John Marshall justified the way in which colonial powers laid claim to lands belonging to pre-existing indigenous people during the age of discovery. The court ruled that due to by then well-established historical precedent that, quote, title to lands lay with a government whose subjects traveled to and occupied a territory whose inhabitants were not subjects of a European Christian monarch. Title to lands lay with a government whose subjects traveled to and occupied a territory whose inhabitants were not subjects of a European Christian monarch. In other words, white people, who through their government, first Europeans and then Americans, had the God-given right to claim lands occupied those they considered to be heathens. And this is just not merely history from some 200 plus years ago. The doctrine of discovery was cited by the United States Supreme Court in City of Sherrill, New York, versus the Oneida Nation in 2005. And I quote, "Under the doctrine of discovery, fee title, meaning ownership, to the lands occupied by Indians when the colonists arrived became vested in the sovereign, first the discovering European nations, and later the original states and the United States." So it's small wonder that in the hills of Idaho, my white kin now own most of the land, and my indigenous cousins live in the margins on their own historic homeland. Though it's vital that we know the whole story of the past, we need not be prisoners to that past. This is true for our personal stories and for cultural megastories. We can indeed forge new futures. On the international level, a European white-centric perspective has been repudiated by the 2007 United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the passage of that declaration as a historic moment when UN member states and indigenous peoples have reconciled with their painful history and are resolved to move forward together on the path of human rights, justice, and development for all. Now, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States originally voted against that declaration, yet all four have subsequently revised their position and signed on. In 2010, speaking at the second White House Tribal Nations Conference, President Obama said he's working hard to live up to the name that was given to him by the Crow Nation, one who helps people throughout the land. Obama has told Native American leaders that he wants to improve the nation-to-nation relationship between the United States and the tribes and to repair broken promises. Such repair work will not be easy, but we are called to begin to do so, not just as governments, but also as people of faith. Our General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association in 2012 passed the following: "Be it resolved that we, the delegates of the 2012 General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association, repudiate the doctrine of discovery as a relic of colonialism, feudalism, and religious, cultural, and racial bias, having no place in the modern-day treatment of indigenous people." No place in the modern day. Other faith traditions, Christians and non-Christians, have done the same. We've begun to explore how we might put some of that into practice. At our 2015 General Assembly, thousands of UUs from across the continent stood in joint witness with the Lummi people. Many in this room were there. The Lummis live just a mile north of us, and we joined with them in taking a stand in opposition to continued desecration of tribal lands, and we passed a resolution there that reads, "Resolved that Unitarian Universalists will support local actions such as the Lummi Nation's opposition to the Gateway Pacific Coal Terminal on sacred lands." Now, this is just a proclamation, but then again, so was that ancient papal decree. And it's an important step in the right direction to say something different. It's a step towards a new future where we may live in harmony with all. Here in this fellowship, you have done even more. Grounded by a direct connection to local tribes and a deep respect for the true history of this place, you've established a Native Community Connections Action Group whose goals are to educate, to deepen respect, and to stand in solidarity. Members of this congregation have participated in the UU College of Social Justice week-long program with alumni called Solidarity with Original Nations and People. And I just found out on a recent post from the College of Social Justice, there are spaces available for this spring's week as well, if you'd like to join that. And this week, as Bruce noted, Dana will join with some of you and members of the larger community for a showing of the film Doctrine of Discovery, Unmasking the Domination Code, an opportunity for you to deepen your understanding of that part of our shared history. We need to look and listen and to share the full story of this, how this continent was not an empty, uninhabited wasteland when our white forebears arrived. It was land that was taken from those who were labeled as other. We need to accept the truth of past injustice and then begin step by step to turn it around. The current reality is that this historic story began long ago, and deconstructing it in order to construct and live out a new story is not an easy process. We cannot change history, but neither do we need to be held prisoner to it. As people of faith, we are called to do what we can to change the future. In here and now, we can support the Lummi in their fight against coal exports. We can continue to support the Sklallan people in here on the peninsula in their continued efforts to restore rivers and salmon runs. And we can lend support for other tribes' efforts in Northern California and Southern Oregon and Alaska and in the hills of Idaho to do the same kind of work. We can skip next year's Columbus Day sale and urge our local and national governments to follow the lead of Seattle and other cities and reclaim it as Indigenous Peoples Day. There's much we can do. It's ours to begin. May we acknowledge errors of the past and begin anew to change ourselves and to change our world. We can make it so.
This is called Heart of the Appaloosa, and this is by Fred Small. And I had the pleasure of seeing Fred Small in concert in mid-80s in Seattle when he was touring all over the place.
From the land of the shooting waters to the peaks of the Coeur d'Alene, thimbleberries in the forest, elk grazing on the plain. The people of Coyote made their camp along the streams of the Green Wallowa Valley when fences had no name. And they bred a strain of horses, the treasure of the tribe, who could toe dance on a ridge or gallop up a mountainside, who could haul the hunter's burden, turn a buffalo stampede. A horse that wore the spotted coat was born with matchless speed. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never died. In the winter came the crowned ones, near frozen in the cold, bringing firearms and spyglasses and a book that saves the soul. The people gave them welcome, nursed them till their strength returned, and studied the talking paper, its mysteries to learn. In the shadow of the mission sprang up farms and squatter towns. The plain was lined with fences, the plow blade split the ground. In the shallows of the clear water, gold glittered in the pan. And the word would come from Washington, remove the Indian. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never dies. Chief spoke to the people in his anger and his pain. I am no more Chief Joseph, Rolling Thunder is my name. They condemn us to a wasteland of barren soil and stone. We shall fight them if we must, but we will find another home. They fled into the Bitterroot, an army at their heels. They fought at Whitebird Canyon, they fought at Misery Hill, till the colonel saw his strategy and sent the order down to kill the Appaloosa wherever it be found. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never dies. 1,200 miles retreating, three times over the divide. The horse, their only safety, their only ally. 3,000 Appaloosas perished with the tribe, the people and the horses dying side by side. Rolling thunder in the mountains said, my heart is sick and sad. Our children now are freezing, the old chiefs are dead. The hunger takes our spirit, our wounds are deep and sore. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never dies. They were sent to Oklahoma, malaria ran rife, but more died of broken hearts far from the land that gave them life. And the man once called Joseph at death was heard to say, we have given up our horses, they have gone away. But sometimes without warning from a dull domestic herd, a spotted horse of spirit, wondrous will emerge. Strong it is and fearless, and nimble on a hill. Listening for the thunder, the Appaloosa's living still. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never dies. Thunder rolling in the mountains, lead the people across the great divide. There's blood on the snow in the hills of Idaho, but the heart of the Appaloosa never dies.